You're listening to the cycling podcast of the 2024 Tour de France with Mitch Docker, Richard Hebram, and Graham Wilcox.
Welcome to the cycling podcast's Tour de France preview episode. Joining me, Graham Wilcox, are the two gentlemen who will be with me following the race and bringing you an episode after every stage of this year's tour, from the Grand Départ in the Renaissance city of Florence on Saturday, all the way to the final time trial in Nice on the 21st of July. It's nearly here, gents. Richard Abraham, hello. Are your bags packed, sir?
They are. They're very packed, which I think is the problem. They might have to be unpacked and a cull going on. How hot is it going to be? Or how cold is it going to be? There's a big puffer jacket.
Are you going to need that for the...
I might need it.
For week three, in high mountains.
The travel kettle is definitely in there. That's not going.
The press centres aren't up at the finish. We can just cruise down the press centre and drink that free wine and keep warm down there and just watch the finish on the TV. What are you talking about, the high mountains?
Fine.
Mitch, right. Love it.
I'll call you for packing advice then, Mitch. There's a whole list of things that are on the cull list.
Cutting to the chase and then what might be on offer in the press room before we've even said hello. Mitch Docker, hello.
Well, yes, I'm dangerously unpacked and I am flying out in less than 12. I'm flying out about 16 hours from now. And I've still got to do a whole lot of packing. I've just got a few things thrown into a bit of a duffel. The puffer jacket didn't even get a look in. I wore the puffer jacket today and just put it neatly on the rack because I was like, it's going to be summer. I threw a rain jacket in. Rain jacket could go pretty handy, I think, if you are sort of cruising around and trying to get interviews in the wet. But apart from that, it's going to be shorts and T-shirt. Working on my winter tan.
How long are you in the air for then, Mitch? I've done that stint from down under a few times and I still get sort of flashbacks. It was a horrible experience every time.
It's about 24 hours. In the air, I think it's like 16 and then maybe 8. Is that right? No, it's less than that. It's 14 and 8. I can't remember exactly. I should know that. But the thing is, I actually really, weirdly, you know, this is a weird story. It's a bit of a side note here. I used to have a coach, Kevin Poulton. He was Australian. He is Australian, sorry. He still is. He lives in just outside of Sydney. And he would fly across 2-3 times a year to work with me. And he'd fly across also. He's the head coach of UAE at the moment. And he'd do other things with different teams. And he'd fly like 5-6 times across Europe. And at the time, I was like, how can you possibly do that, Kev? He said, Mitch, you aren't going to believe it, but I actually enjoy the time up there. It's the only time I get to myself where I'm not sort of like bogged down with phone messaging. I can concentrate on, you know, doing my programs. I can actually read on some things. And weirdly, the last couple of years, it's something I look forward to, is that time on the flight. I get that time to myself. I can watch a movie guilt-free, sink a couple of cold ones, maybe do a little bit of work. You know, just have that quiet time to let my brain sort of settle. Maybe have a look through that Tour de France. I haven't even looked at those stages yet. Catch up, get ready to report to you guys.
Well, Mitch, I was thinking, because me and Richard probably think about the tour as 3 weeks, but for you, it's more like a month, isn't it? By the time you've closed the front door and to the point where you'll open it again. So it's a proper stint for you, mate.
It is. It's dawned on me tonight. And a couple of people, I just got back from the Lanny Run Club. It is Tuesday night. Shout out to anyone who wants to join us, 6 o'clock at the Lancefield Pub.
Not for the next month. Mitch won't be there.
Well, we had a cleansing ale after, a bit of a, you know, see you later. And they're going to try and keep it going for the next month. But a few of the guys were asking me, you know, you're looking forward to it? And I said, I'm weirdly not at this point. I'm feeling a bit sort of sad that I'm leaving. I know once I get there, I'll be super excited. But to leave the family here for a month, exactly that. It's going to be sad to walk away from the kids. But yeah, once I get there, once I get on that flight, you guys know it. Any time when you get to the airport, you get excited.
Get that little buzz. Well, look, we better crack on, gents, because Mitch has got to get to the airport. He's got to pack his bags and get going. We're going to attack our tour preview, taking it week by week and pulling out some of the most interesting talking points that might give us a good indication of how the race will go. But before we do that, Richard, shall we do a corrections corner and something that Mitch, I have a feeling, might have been waiting for all week?
The Mitch rehabilitation corner.
Because what have I done now? Here we go.
The thing is, I think I did know this at the back of my mind, but while we were recording last week, it was kind of more fun to let Mitch just sort of go along with it And yeah, well, Mitch, someone's written into Graham. You've got the name of our dolphin correspondent.
Shall I take the first one? Which is long time listener Richard Powger, and he writes that in last week's Tour de France build up episode, Mitch was called out for pronouncing the Dauphiné as the dolphin, eh? Now, forgive me for the accent, Mitch. Now, I've been hearing him pronounce it like this for years, and with his nice Aussie accent, I like it, writes Richard. The plot twist here, he continues, is that the Dauphiné takes place in the region historically given to the heir apparent of the French kingdom when it existed, with the heir being known as the Dauphin. The coat of arms? Well, that bears an image of a dolphin. Why? Well, because dauphin is French for dolphin.
For dolphin. I said that. And that's why we call it the Dauphiné. I didn't want to go out on a limb, but thank you. I love this.
And we should add that Chris Wolfe has also written in to say he thinks it's fine to rename the Dauphiné as the dolphin, eh? As long as you do it on porpoise. On porpoise.
Very clever. Yeah, look, it'll be forever the Dauphiné in my mind. The dolphin. If you're rolling around the peloton, you want to talk to a pro and you want to feel like you're in the loop, refer to the Dauphiné as the dolphin.
Consider yourself vindicated, Mitch, and on behalf of both Richard and myself, we apologise and we will defer to you for all geography lessons and
for the following 3 weeks, any pronunciation duties, Mitch, any French phone calls, they're on you.
No, everyone's going to be seriously tuning out if I have to pronounce all the French names and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And people will remember from years before, I am notoriously very bad at pronunciation.
All those brush up on all those Cofidis riders that are going to be in the TV breakaways who are going to ask you to reel off every day.
Well, Francois is going to be cringing.
Yes, quite right. But there we are, boys. We don't always get it right, but it turns out Mitch almost always does. So on that note, should we have a bit of news?
Let's crack on with the news. Well, excuse me, while we're getting ready to go to the tour, news that we're going to be joined by a couple of other important characters. Jonas Vingegaard and Wout van Aert are going. That was still TBC last time when we recorded last week. Vingegaard going as the sole leader of Visma Lisabike, which is, well, a real statement of intent and faith in last year's winner. Matteo Jorgensen is going, second at the Dauphiné, of course, Dauphiné. He will be going there very much as a helper. And, you know, a statement from Marijn Zeeman, the boss of Visma Lisabike, about Jorgensen, and sort of saying, one day maybe he can win the Tour de France, but this year he's going as a support rider. However, a little story I've just spotted this morning, Sepp Kuss will not be there. He was in the list for Visma Lisabike, but he hasn't recovered in time from a COVID-19 infection at the Dauphiné. It seems to have been a bit of this about. David Gaudu came down with it. Theo Gegenhardt also suffering from COVID-19. He broke a rib at the Dauphiné, so he will not be at the Tour. That nasty disease is rearing its head again and having an impact on the Tour once more. However, the Visma Lisabike squad, besides Vingegaard and Wout van Aert, we have Tejs Benoot, Christophe Laporte, Jan Tratnik, Wilco Kelderman and Bart Lemon. So still a pretty strong team. Well, not much racing to talk about this week. However, there were a lot of national championships, certainly in Europe at least. I mean, a lot of the big name riders weren't there. The Super Six, Pogacar, Vingegaard, Roglic, Evenepoel, Cavendish. Sorry, Cavendish isn't the Super Six. Maybe he should be. Van der Poel. They weren't there. Let's not be exhaustive. We don't need to name them all. But some of the names who will be wearing the national colours at this year's Tour. Alberto Bettiol, Italian champion. Arnaud Delis, Belgian champion, who, interestingly, beat Jasper Philipsen, Jordi Meus, Wout van Aert and Tim Malia in the Belgian Championships. It should be said that Lotto Destiny brought 18 riders with them, plus two from the development squad. So he had a team of 19 pulling for him. He really should have won that, shouldn't he?
Yes, arguably should have won it by more. Yes. But it's some result, that, given his competition.
Quite.
But I can just quickly argue that doesn't actually always help. I remember when we started with maybe not 19, but very close to 19, let's say 17, between 17 and 19 riders at the first Green Edge appearance at the Australian Nationals back in 2012. And because everyone thinks, oh, you know what? We've got 19 guys. I'm actually on a bad one. There's so many other guys. I'm just going to flip off. You know, I'm out. And another guy goes, yeah, cool. We've still got like 15 blokes there. I'm out. Next thing you know, we were left with like three guys left with about six laps to go. I was like, holy shit, we actually better win this because we started with 19. And luckily we had Simon Gerrans in our back pocket and he did win because we would have looked like an ultimate fool of a team. So it doesn't always work that well having heaps of numbers.
Well, it got me wondering. Got me wondering where his sprint train might have started. Sort of 50 kilometres out.
a couple of kilometres each. Probably not far off, eh? Well, it was the same in France anyway. For Paul Lapeyre, who will be going to the Tour for Decathlon Agir d'Azur La Mondiale, they had 14 World Tour riders and 6 development team riders in their squad. So, yeah, seems like their tactic is emerging. A few other names: Dylan Groenewegen, the Netherlands; Alex Aramburu, Spanish national champion now; and, well, Slovenia, probably the hardest national championships when everybody turns up. That was won by Domen Novak, who was, of course, Pogacar's super domestique in the spring and in the Giro. A bit of controversy in sportsmanship to report in Denmark. Mathias Skelmoser was awarded first place in the time trial championships. However, the fastest on the day, Johan Price Pedersen, was DQ'd for riding on a bike path. Graham Ure in Copenhagen, probably quite hard not to ride on bike paths in a race in Denmark.
Almost impossible.
The commissaires DQ'd him. They thought he'd gained an advantage, I think a bit of shelter from the breeze, if anything. Skelmoser has actually written on social media that he didn't agree with it, and he wants to offer Price Pedersen the jersey and the medal that he was presented with as a sort of gesture to recognise the effort. Which I thought was quite a nice little story of sportsmanship there.
So do you think, I was wondering, I read this story too, do you think he will wear the champion's jersey in the TTs?
I suspect he is obliged to, is he not?
What happens if you don't?
I don't know, actually.
Well, you presumably take the fine every time.
I would imagine there's a fine.
That's a hell of a sporting gesture. I would imagine it ends with him saying, here's the jersey on the day. But yeah,
I have heard of stories of riders being fined because they didn't wear the correct national champions jersey, at least in the past. I'm not sure whether that's the current regs, but
yeah, but it normally works, it always goes the other way normally, because we want to be more loud. You want to paint it everywhere, and then they go, hey, that's too much. It doesn't normally go the other way. Not many guys, I can't even remember someone going, I don't want to wear the national champions jersey.
I wonder whether it's happened in a TT. Like, I think it might have happened in a mountain TT once, where, you know, someone didn't want to wear their TT skin suit. This was a while ago, before skin suits were more important. I'll have to check that. But yeah,
I remember when Armstrong didn't want to wear the yellow jersey when Zabriskie lost it in that team's time trial that year when he was running for CSC, and the ASO wanted to throw him out of the race if he didn't wear it.
Yeah, that's definitely a rule, isn't it? That's why, you know, that was a big issue, I guess, 10 years ago, before Le Coq Sportif came in as jersey sponsors and really upped their game in the aerodynamic side of things, because it was actually a disadvantage to be wearing a yellow jersey or any classification jersey in a time trial. And so it was almost, you know, the ideal scenario going into a TT was to not have it and then take it after the TT. But that's less of the case now, I think, given the work that the sponsors do. Anyway, let's crack on. We could be here all day with the news roundup. One rider who will miss the tour, well, a couple actually, who it's worth mentioning given the stories that were coming out the last few weeks, Chris Froome and Mike Woods. Neither has been selected for Israel Premier Tech, despite the reports in L'Équipe the other week saying that Chris Froome was a sort of nailed on cert. But that team pretty much going all in for Derek G in the tour. Let's move on to Andrea Piccoli, shall we? Let's just go through what's been reported at the moment. EF Pro Cycling has terminated Andrea Piccoli's contract. So the rider was stopped by Italian law enforcement last Friday on suspicion of transporting human growth hormone. It's a tricky case with a few threads. So according to the team, Piccolo was suspended without pay by EF in March for taking a sleeping aid that was legal but not approved by the team. EF wanted to dismiss Piccolo at the time, but were unable to because of what it said were legal issues surrounding the UCI standard rider contract. Now, the team says it did nevertheless report the issue to the UCI at the time. Piccolo was then selected for the Giro, where his best result was fourth on stage six, and then he abandoned on stage 19. According to Gazzetta dello Sport, the Italian paper, Piccolo was travelling back to Italy from Colombia last Friday, where he'd been training in Colombia, and he was stopped in Italy on arrival. The UCI has issued a statement clarifying that the investigation has been led by the Independent Testing Agency, the ITA, which has worked with the National Anti-Doping Agency, in this case the Italians, and Italian law enforcement. So, I mean, for sort of good reporting on this, go to Escape Collective. They've really led the way in reporting on this, and they've got a lot of further details, including text messages reportedly sent by Piccolo to the EF team boss, Jonathan Vauters. Human growth hormone, it goes without saying, that is definitely a prohibited substance, and under the WADA code, the trafficking or attempted trafficking of a prohibited substance carries a minimum suspension of 4 years. And the Italian newspaper Corriere della Sella is also reporting that Piccolo is likely to face criminal disciplinary proceedings as well. Piccolo has an interesting past. He signed for Astana in 2021, but he never raced for them. He did one race for Gazprom at the start of 2022 before signing for, I have to say this in an Italian accent, I should probably delegate to someone else. Rob, where's Rob Hatch when we need him? Drone Per Androni Giocattoli. So he raced for Androni in 2022. And then he did the Vuelta as a stagiaire with EF last year before signing fully for them at the start of this year. So, yeah, an interesting little story.
And he's only 23, isn't he?
Yeah.
Mitch, I wanted to ask you about this, partly because it's a team you know well, and partly just to get the rider's point of view. So let's start with that. How do you feel as a rider, or how might you feel as a rider, because I'm not going to assume that this has happened in your past, when a story like this gets out? Because we were talking in the week, weren't we, briefly over WhatsApp, and your immediate response was sort of, well, the same as the rest of us, holy hell.
Did I actually say that?
I paraphrase, yeah.
Yeah, look, it's just like so crushing and disappointing. You know, especially in your team, you know that teams are just on a thread these days. And news like this can actually sort of put the team in jeopardy. You know, like, it's not a given, you know. It's just, you just never know what impact this is going to have on your career. You know, your team could shut down. You could suddenly be affected. And that's the thing that I know. Everyone, there's a ripple effect from that. And everyone in the wake from that is going to feel some kind of effect. You know, if it's just riders getting questioned more than they normally would, you know, interrogated, maybe tested a hell of a lot more suddenly now. You know, like, there's just going to be a whole lot of heat on a lot of riders that never would have, you know, needed it or wanted it.
You're looking forward to the Tour de France, and all of a sudden this is the only thing that anyone's going to want to ask you about.
Exactly. You know, it puts this whole sort of negative light on them, on the team. It's such a shame. You know, look, I reached out to Tom Southam to try and get a little bit more light on it, and I really just treaded lightly because didn't want to seem like I was just another, you know, hungry journalist trying to get a bit of a bite. And, you know, naturally he was sort of like a bit... hesitant and sort of held back a bit, and I was like, yeah, no worries, like, yeah, I just wanted to sort of hear the light, make sure you're all okay. But, you know, what I gathered is that the one little bit of information he told me was he was never really following team protocol anyway when it came to a lot of other things, you know, whether it was nutritional advice, whether it was coaching advice. He was a bit of a lone cat, and, you know, that was the one thing I took out of our little conversation, is that, you know, he was sort of, you know, very hard to read anyway, and just sort of did his own thing. So that was one thing they did sort of struggle with, is that, hey, when you're in a team, you know, you've got all this personnel around you, and if suddenly you're just, you know, at that age of 23, and I'm only making this assumption myself, but when you're at the age of 23, to be sort of know everything and just be like, cool, I don't need any help from a World Tour team that's been doing it for, you know, numerous amounts of years with these experts, sort of seems a bit strange anyway, in my mind. That's probably, yeah. And I'm really interested to see what happens out of this. What kind of person, you know, growth hormone, it's pretty old school, isn't it? You don't hear about that much anymore.
The whole thing's got an old school flavour to it. I mean,
it's very old school.
the first thing you have to think about is the Festina affair.
Going
across, bringing performance enhancing drugs across a border, right before Tour de France, and it's got some serious echoes. Obviously, to a lesser extent, because you're talking about an individual rider here, and not an entire team. But that's the first place that my mind jumped to, as I'm sure a lot of people's did.
Totally, yeah. And look, and I'm really interested to see, and very sort of aware when we go across there and start talking AEF, that's not the first thing I ask those guys about.
Let's move on to the world of mountain biking briefly. Sorry, Daniel, Lionel. Tom Pidcock won again off-road, the latest round of the World Cup in Crans-Montana in Switzerland. Pidcock has been announced on the Ineos Grenadiers Tour team earlier this week, I believe, recently, last few days. He is going with Carlos Rodriguez and Egan Bernal, a kind of two-prong GC approach there, supported by Laurens de Plus, very impressive in the Dauphiné, Jonathan Castroviejo, Michał Kwiatkowski. Mitch, I can see you grinning. I'm not going to... Not every time we mention it. Kwiatkowski, Ben Turner, and Geraint Thomas. One more tour for him. Interesting kind of program for Pidcock. I mentioned that he features in a little series of Kilometer Zeros, which has been keeping me busy the last couple of months, all about the Tour de France in Yorkshire 10 years ago. We've called it Humongous Bunting, which was a sort of mysterious quote, which we did eventually manage to track down. It's out tomorrow for people who are subscribers to the Cycling Podcast. And as a Kilometer Zero, you can sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com, where you'll find all the Kilometer Zero episodes. Plus, there'll be some stuff from us at the tour. I know Lionel's been going back over his favourites and sort of giving them a mention in the 1101 Cappuccino Substack. So I'll go back and have a look, and I think and queue up a few of them for the... Well, it's only 2 hours from London to Nice, unfortunately. But maybe get a couple in there. And finally, Romain Bardet. This will be his final Tour de France. He's announced he's going to be retiring in 2025. His last race will be the... sorry, Mitch. Criterium du Dauphiné. And then he's going to make a switch, interestingly, to gravel. He's going to, I think, target the Gravel World Champs, which are in Nice next year. And as Bardet leaves, one rider will be returning. Anna van der Breggen will return to the peloton next year. She's been a DS at SD Works since 2022. She retired in 21 with 3 rainbow jerseys, 7 Flèche Wallons, 4 Giri, an Olympic gold, 2 Liège, Baston Liège, and so on, and the rest. Van der Breggen will be 34, and obviously kind of coincides with the departure or expected departure of Demi Vollering from SD Works at the end of the year. So yeah, that would be really quite interesting to see how Van der Breggen goes. She said she's needed a new kind of a rest after the Tokyo Games in 2021, but simply missed the competition, and is going to return with what she said, a sort of a new perspective on enjoying the sport rather than winning particular races, which I think is quite a nice way to do it. So good luck, Anna.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, and this is Lionel here to tell you that this episode is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, the guys have got everything they need for the Tour de France. They've got all the recording equipment. Hopefully, they've got all the various plug adapters and wires that they need, their passports, of course. And hopefully they've also got a NordVPN account. And if they haven't, well, they can, like all of our listeners, get a great discount, an exclusive NordVPN deal at nordvpn.com/TCP. Now, what is a VPN? Well, it's a virtual private network. And I think that when you're traveling around and about, logging onto the internet in hotels or cafes or even the Tour de France press room, a VPN guarantees that your data is safe and secure. And I signed up as a NordVPN customer a long while ago because I was just a bit concerned logging onto the internet here, there and everywhere that my data might be vulnerable to being hijacked. And when you're logging into your email or logging onto the bank account, you really don't want that data to be hijacked by anyone for nefarious purposes. So NordVPN gives you that guarantee, that safety and security that your data is going to be safe from any hackers. It's really easy to use. You connect in one click and it doesn't slow down your internet connection. It supports every major platform, Windows, Android, Apple, iOS, and you can use it on up to 6 devices. So if you're traveling around with your laptop, phone and tablet, and when you're at home, you could even protect your smart TV. If you're a Cycling Podcast listener, which of course you all are, you can get a great deal at nordvpn.com/TCP. It's risk-free as well because there's a 30-day money-back guarantee, and I'll put that link in the episode show notes. Now, before I hand back to Graham, Mitch and Richard, I want to mention again the event that's happening in Scotland at the West Lothian Cycle Circuit in Linlithgow on Saturday, July the 20th, to commemorate our very dear friend Richard Moore. A plaque is going to be unveiled by Mark Beaumont, the world record round the world cyclist, of course. And the plaque has been made by our dear friend Stacey Snyder. She made the clay that was then cast in bronze, and that plaque to commemorate Richard and his contribution to Scottish cycling, well, cycling in general, will be placed somewhere on the circuit, and it will be unveiled on Saturday, July the 20th. The plaque unveiling will be at 11 o'clock. The circuit will be open from 10 until 1. So bring your bike if you can make it. Come and join us for a few laps. Wear your Cycling Podcast jersey or casquette if you've got one. And if you can't bring your bike, just come along for a cup of tea. Richard's dad, Brian, and Richard's brothers, Robin and Peter, would love as many Cycling Podcast listeners and friends of the podcast to make it. I'll be there. Stacey Snyder's coming over from the US. Brian has promised that the sun will be shining. So come and join us for a few laps or a cup of tea on Saturday, July the 20th. And speaking of Stacey, her Tour de France cups will go on sale on Sunday, sometime during stage 2. I'll put all of the details in this week's edition of the 1101 Cappuccino, which is free to sign up to. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com if you're not already a subscriber. That's more than enough from me for now. Back to Graham, Richard and Mitch.
Right then, gents. The Tour de France is upon us. I know we're all tremendously excited. We're going to try and slow it down here and just take it week by week because, first of all, it's an anything but familiar route this year, not the traditional loop around France clockwise or anti-clockwise. So we begin in Florence, as we've been very excited about for weeks. Three of the five longest stages in this year's tour, all more than 200 kilometres, are those first three stages in Italy. Aside from that, we've got two individual time trials for a total of 59 kilometres, four mountaintop finishes taking in the Apennines, the Alps, the Pyrenees and the Massif Central, a series of gravel sections on stage 9, which is definitely going to add something a little different to the mix. And of course, that final, one of the two time trials, that final hilly time trial to Nice, not Paris, because of the ongoing preparation for the Olympics later in the summer. All of which will surely create a much more open race, or we hope will create a much more open race. All of that for a total of almost 3,500 kilometres of racing with more than 52,000 metres of elevation. That's 20% more than this year's Giro d'Italia. So stage one, Saturday, Mitch will be getting on a plane and it's almost as soon as he gets off, we're going to be driving down from Nice to the Piazzale Michelangelo for the rollout of stage one. Florence to Rimini is stage one, Cesenatico to Bologna, then for stage two, stage three, Piacenza to Turin and a possible first chance for the sprinters. And then stage four goes from Italy over the border back into France with Pinerolo to Valois. And the earliest ever in the Tour de France, earliest ever visit to the Col de Galibier. What do we make, gents, of this first week, which seems to have huge opportunity for breakaways, huge opportunities, early opportunities for the main men on the GC to try and put some time into each other? Will we see, let's start with this question, Mitch, will we see a surprise attack for the yellow jersey on stage one, given the amount of climbing from Florence to Florence to Rimini?
I've made a little note. I've been through all the stages. I was joking before when I was going to use the flight. I've actually had a look at the stages. And my note here was effing tough start to the Tour de France. and that is understating it. This first stage is ridiculous. 3,800 meters of climbing, just up and down the whole day. This is so brutal. Like, this is just going to be, you got to remember too, like, you're trying to remember last year when the stage started, the stress that they had there in Spain, because there was no TT, that, like, it doesn't elude all the stress, but it does take a little bit of the stress out, because there is an element of the ranking order where people see it and there's a jersey and people control and all that stuff. To have a stage like this, there's four Cat 3 climbs, three Cat 2s. The last, top of the last climb is at 26K to go, a fast run into Rimini. I think it's going to be purely, I've written down Mohorič and Pidcock, because I feel like you got to be able to climb, but you got to be able to just descend and just go Hail Mary to the finish. And it's going to be a fight to get that jersey. There always is a fight in that first week when they're a few seconds off and whatever. So I think the first stage, hell to ride, great to watch. It's going to be so good to watch. This is just, and in Italy too, it's just got a different feel. The roads are slightly different. We know that from the Giro just recently, but it's a real, they've done well. This stage is going to be brutal. 206K as well. Like, it's not short. It's going to be a big one.
If this stage was in the middle of the Giro,
Rich, is it?
You know, if it were at, like, let's say stage 7, when the race wiggles its way to Tuscany, and it's got all these, like, narrow, tricky roads, like, up and down all day, twisty, turny. They go through San Marino, and I was thinking, oh, maybe I can tick off another country on my kind of Europe checklist. And I was like, and then I looked at the road and was like, nah, we're not driving that. That's going to be, we'll just take the whole course and get to the press room. But it's not easy to control, is it? It's fast. It's, you know, you can imagine the bunch being spread out. And if it were in the middle of the Giro, you'd think, well, this is a GC day. Nailed down. This is a day where we're going to see some sort of shake up in the GC.
I thought about, sorry, Mitch, you go.
No, I didn't have anything else to say to that. I was just about to say something stupid, like, it's proper hard. You know, like, it is proper hard. There's nothing more to add. Go, you say something more intelligent than that.
Well, I'll give it a go. I was going to ask, will we see a surprise attack for the yellow jersey, and who will it be? So if you had to know, will it be, for example, Alberto Bettiol, who we've just seen take the Italian champions jersey? Is it going to be too hard for him? Are the GC teams going to be working so hard to control the race that it's going to be impossible for anyone to get away? Bettiol, my first thought, partly because they're home roads for him, Tuscany, partly because he will want to honour the jersey on his back and the first race day, swap it out for the yellow jersey. That will also, as we've just been talking about, give EF a huge boost, and give them something else to focus on, and everyone else something else to focus on instead of the questions around Piccolo. If it's not Bettiol, Richard, who else might it be?
I think it could be any of about 50 riders. I mean, I probably agree with you, Mitch, that it's, you know, someone like Pidcock or Mohorič, someone, you know, you're going to have to be comfortable climbing. Bettiol, is it going to be on the limits of what he's capable of? I don't know. But
I like Bettiol. I think it's a good shout.
I think it's really hard to speculate, because it's one of those stages where, you know, you could make a team and a rider and a team's tour by winning that stage and getting the yellow jersey. And then that's kind of job done. If you're, like, we mentioned Cofidis already, but if you're one of those French teams, or, I mean, any team really that doesn't have a GC rider or a clear sprinter, of which that's probably makes up 50% of the peloton, that, you know, that's a huge reward. And so I think that's, as well as all the GC favourites who are going to be vigilant and maybe slightly conscious of taking the jersey so early, if they did, there's going to be a whole host of, you know, stage hunters in there who aren't interested in the GC in Nice at the end of it all, but are definitely interested in that stage.
And talking of stage hunters then, Romain Bardet and Dea Sam.
Yeah.
Easy win, well, not an easy win, but definitely a clear choice for them early on. While there is or what will presumably be plenty of chaos going on in the bunch. If it doesn't happen on stage one, you've then got the famous climb to the Basilica St. Luca in Bologna on stage two. And in fact, you've got two laps of it. Mitch, I'm going to come back to you on notes, partly because that's a climb that your mate Gero has sort of made famous in your homeland, having taken a win there, I want to say in the Giro. Simon Gerrans, of course. What do we make of stage two? Because there is opportunity there for more gaps on GC / a possible another breakaway day.
It's a launch pad for an attack on that San Luca climb. Look, we could even see Pogacar going away there. You know, like you never put it past him, or you know, even Vanderpol. Like these guys that just sort of love that aggressive racing, 12k to go, really lay it on the line. It's another, like, I wouldn't say if you win stage one it's a guarantee you're going to have the jersey for a couple of days. It's just set up again to sort of explode again on stage two. Two really hard stages right there.
And it's worth saying, if you do want to wear the yellow jersey as well, now's the time. If you're not a GC rider and you want a bit of a stint in yellow, you got to do it early, because the fact they go over to the Col de Galibier and the finish in Valois on stage four, that's going to rule out pretty much anybody who's not in that GC hunt. And the jersey will be, I would imagine, after that stage, someone who's going to finish in the top 10 will be wearing it.
Yeah, Mitch, just give us a word on that as well, because that stage four, heading into the Alps, as I said earlier, the earliest ever visit to the the Galibier, rolls out of Pinerolo on the plane and climbs. I mean, you go high very, very quickly to Sestriere, and finishing in Valois. But before you get to the descent to Valois, you've got the Galibier. As a rider, are you looking at that going, stage four? Come on, lads, everyone calm down. This is getting a bit silly straight away.
Yeah, well, it's a very solid stage. Again, you know, almost 4,000 metres of climbing with the Galibier. Descend to the finish, look, I think, once again, it's going to suit someone who obviously can handle themselves on a descent to the finish. Like, they're literally descending straight down into it off the Galibier. It's, you know, brutal is the word that gets used very, very often. I try not to use it all the time, but it is a very brutal start to this year's tour. And look, from the sprinter's point of view, it's, you know, it's the worst sort of scenario you could hope for.
But they will have a chance in that first week. And stage nine, boys, the gravel stage, in and out of Troyes, 14 sectors of gravel that start just after 47 kilometres. The stage itself runs nearly 200 Ks. And the final six of those gravel sectors are packed into the final 35 Ks. Richard Plugger has come out this week and said, it's going to have far too many people depending on sort of riding their luck. And it's going to do the opposite of it increases bad luck, he said. And while you sort of want the various stages to sort of even things out, he says it's a bit unnecessary. It increases the chance of bad luck. We want the fight to be as fair as possible. But a ride like this, in my opinion, does not contribute to that. What do we make of this one?
I mean, it's not like the gravel is selectively puncturing all the riders wearing the new Visma Lisa bike blue kit, is it? I mean, luck is a part of bike racing, isn't it? Luck is a part of life and any sporting competition. I'm not sure I agree with that.
Is this worse than the Roubaix stage last year? Like, there's no way, you know, like they're just riding on a bit of dirt roads. Like, it's, you know, they're trying to compare it to a Strada Bianchi, but it's got nothing of the sort. Not that I've ridden the gravel, but, you know, just looking at the terrain itself. They've got four Cat 4s, not overly aggressive. When you compare it to a Strada Bianchi, it's completely different. Right through the Champagne region, actually, which is quite nice. I'm quite looking forward to this stage. I like that they're mixing it up with this sort of stuff, because it keeps a stage like this really exciting, and it takes a different GC rider you know, again, paints that picture of an all-round sort of winner of a race. Let's think back, like, back to the days when Nibali was tearing it up on the cobblestones. That opened my eyes up to, hang on, you don't have to be a big, fat-ass classic rider to ride cobblestones. You can be Fuslang, and Nibali shredded it on the stones. So that's what shows me, and that's what I like about these stages. They uncover all-round riders.
And looking at that first week as well, it's almost like that would make a great Dauphiné or, you know, a week-long stage race. It's got mountain stages, a few possible sprints. It's got the TT, which is kind of, it's hilly, but it's not mountainous. So that's sort of open to a lot of riders. It's a really nice mix, isn't it? And like, if you kind of think of it as a, you know, the narrative of the whole race and how, what the organizers are looking for, it's like, there's that big kind of opening statement of Italy and like the bang, like here we are straight away, straight into the Tour de France, straight into the Alps. And then it's that kind of slightly more subtle, but equally important, like the TT and these kind of lumpy stages through, like, through Burgundy, which is, you know, not a huge tour staple, is it? I had to look the last time the tour finished in Dijon just to check whether Mark Cavendish had won there. I mean, generally, if you pick a French town, Cav's normally won in it, but he hasn't won in Dijon. I think the tour hasn't been there for quite a while. So, you know, that's kind of, it's a nice way to like introduce this whole region, I think, to the race and to the people following it as well. Like, there's a lot going on there.
Yeah, so individual time trial, first ITT, 25Ks, stage 7. Two flat stages before that, so two chances for the sprinters, a flat stage following it, and then we hit that gravel stage on stage 9. Just one more word on the gravel stage, gents. It always makes me think of Cadel Evans. I'm trying to give it an Australian flavour, again, for Mitch's sake. But he had that famous quote after the Strada Bianchi stage in the 2010 Giro, when he said it was like taking an F1 car off-road for a rally. And part of the reason for that is because it rained so heavily that you know, you just had mud clogging up your gears and derailleurs all over the place. But part of what Evans did there, if memory serves, was he was using his water bottle to... because he's got a mountain bike background, hasn't he? And this is what he used to do on the mountain bike. He was using his water bottle to spray the mud off his chain set so that it wasn't affected in the same way, possibly, as the other riders. Yeah, but that always makes me think of Cadel.
And I actually plugged to my own self. It was really interesting. He said that when I interviewed him last year about that, about how much his mountain bike skills really helped him there. And once again, that's what I love about these stages, and I'm not saying we need to have a million of them in a race. One is enough, but what it does is it produces the most, in my opinion, the all-round winner, the rider that deserves to win a Grand Tour, not just someone who can climb really well. You know, they've got a time trial, they've got to be able to handle themselves in the crosswinds, they've got to be able to handle themselves on the cobbles or, you know, the gravel. It's the Tour de France, they've got to be the best rider at the end.
We've got the rest day in Orléans, and then we've got three flat stages and three mountain stages before the next rest day comes around. On the flats, then, should we have a little word about someone that we've not talked much about at all? We've kind of kept our powder dry on Mark Cavendish and Astana. What has to happen in any of these sprint stages for Mark Cavendish to take win number 35 at the Tour de France and take the record outright from Eddy Merckx?
Well, look, I think having Michael Morkov is the big key element this year. A guy, what he really missed last year, and that's definitely no disrespect to, say, Case Bol, because, you know, he was learning on the fly there and doing a really good job. They brought Mark Renshaw in last year as well to sort of help. And we've seen that in the Netflix series, but, you know, understanding, talking to him on the ground last year and understanding what his role was there. It was a Von course. It was setting up those sprints, how they were going to approach it, just because he'd worked so closely with Mark. Mark Renshaw now is a sports director on the team, and he's been working with the team throughout the whole season. So in the combination of that, working with the sprint train all year, having Michael Morkov involved again, Mark Cavendish and him working very well together back in Quickstep, but also, you know, you can't doubt that Mirkou or Michael Morkov, in my opinion, is the best lead out man I've seen in the last sort of, you know, 5-6 years. He is his experience, and you see him, he's so calm when he's out there. And the fact that Cavendish has that confidence in his lead out man again, that's a big part of lead outs. You know, Chase Bowl, I don't know whether he had that confidence in him just purely because he was slightly inexperienced. He had the power, but he needs to understand that role. So this is the key element for me. There is a few stages that do suit him, but it's the same as the other sprinters. There's nothing that really stands out for me, purely a stage for Cav, other than when we get to the third week after the rest day, which is stage 16. But I'm sure we'll get to that in a minute. It's a stage that he's won. It's a stage that, you know, deep into a race, that's where his experience is going to come into play. It's a stage that's got other elements, crosswinds, the fact that he's won there before, all those things are kind of come into play if he hasn't already won a stage before then.
I was kind of looking at the route, and I agree with you, Mitch. I reckon stage 16 there into Nîmes, he's won there before in 2008, which I think counts for a lot. When you hear Mark speak about what's important and how he looks at the finishes, you know, he'll quite often remember, oh yeah, that was the place where I won in, you know, that time where we go left at this roundabout and we do this and this and this, blah, blah, blah. And it's familiar. And I think that's kind of a key part of his approach. Although, you know, what you said, Graham, it is interesting how we haven't really discussed it. And I think that's partly because Mark Cavendish hasn't had a particularly noteworthy year full of victories where everyone's thinking, right, this guy's flying for the Tour. But I think...
He won a stage at the Tour of Hungary. Was his last kind of... the last time he properly stuck his head above the parapet. And then yesterday you might have seen Astana on their social media platforms sort of roll a film with Cavendish talking about how everything's set, everything's in place. They don't have to learn how each other works in the sprint train. It's all, you know, it's all set fair, ready to go. And Project 35 is, yeah, it's on.
And there's that kind of understanding, I think, for anybody following the sport. And I don't know, I kind of subconsciously, I think, I believe he'll be ready. You know, he hasn't got the wins that state that he's going to be beating Philipsen, have they? I'm not even sure if they've come head-to-head this year. I think Philipsen is the rider to beat, probably, in terms of the main competition in the sprint. Although, actually, there's a lot to like if you're Michael Matthews, I think, in this Tour. A lot of those kind of not quite sprint, hilly, lumpy sprint stages, or stages with a little kick in at the end that could just make it hurt if you're one of the real big boys. Or, you know, those sort of slightly classic-y, grippy roads that are tricky to control.
And I think that suits Mads Pedersen as well.
Yeah.
As the race gets harder, typically, automatically gives Mads Pedersen a greater chance of winning. Before we move on from Mark Cavendish, Mitch, talk to me about Mark Renshaw and just how gutted he was when Cav crashed out last year. Because you would have spoken to him afterwards. He's a man you know well. And it all came tumbling down.
Yeah, it was... I didn't really know the full extent of what had gone on, and everyone was sort of trying to work it out, and we're around the buses at the end of the stage, and I ran into Mark and I said, mate, what's the verdict, you know, what's going on? Because at that point there, you got to remember, that was, he was retiring, that was his last hurrah, and so it was, nothing was open, like I'm going to ride on or all that stuff. That came out in the next few days, but Renshaw was actually glassy eyed. He was, you know, even maybe shed a tear, I don't know, but he was very emotional, you could see. And he was just like, that's not the way we wanted to end this. No one wants to end like that. And I could see he was so connected to it. He was on board on the project then. And if so, even more so now. So it was quite an emotional sort of confrontation that I had with him after that stage, or at the finish around the buses. But, you know, following that, it was quite weird. And we drew the parallel very quickly. But... Mark reached out to me, would have been the next day maybe, and he said, hey mate, you don't have Morkov's number, do you?
And, you know, I did actually. I said, oh, yeah, I do. I'll pass it on to you. And I was sitting in the car with Lionel at the time. I said, actually, Rendog just messaged me, asked for Morkov's number. Should we break the news? And, you know, Lionel joked. He goes, oh, well, he's going across to Astana. And, yeah, he did. So you heard it here first. I had a big part in that. Huge.
Big part to play in Tour de France, potential Tour de France history. Richard, we should probably end with a word in terms of the sprinters and the contenders for the green jersey on a man whose last visit to the Tour de France saw him take the points jersey. Sam Bennett.
That's a good point. Yeah, Sam Bennett kind of back in a little... A sort of form resembling Bennett at his best, I think, at times this year. And I don't know, I was looking through the Decathlon Azur Desert team and thinking, like, well, these guys have been firing all year, haven't they? Like, superseding expectations. Where now you kind of think, well, if they carry on doing that, they're gonna be due some kind of nice stuff in the Tour. They're taking Paul Lapeyre, aren't they? Who just won the French champs. That kind of like... He's a bit of a multi-tool, I think, that sort of sprinter, fast finish, but can climb pretty well. Young guy, though. But, yeah, Bennett, has he got... I'm not just trying to remind myself who he's taking with him, but I'm not sure I'd put Bennett quite up in the bracket of Philipsen and Alpecin de Koenig. Also, Wout van Aert, let's remember, he's not going with any kind of support there for those stages, but you think if Wout van Aert is anything like the Wout van Aert we remember, he's going to be... in the mix too on anything that, you know, has a fast finish. Arnaud Delis, we talked about him in the championship roundup. You know, it's his first Tour. Let's see what he can do. I'm really looking forward to these kind of like, it's like the middle part of the race between sort of stages 6 and before we get to the Pyrenees. Like it's just a really nice reminder that France isn't just Alps and Pyrenees and then sort of flat sunflower fields in between that's just like the filler, because these are all towns. I was, you know, looking at these towns that we go through, and half of them I've never even heard of, let alone been to them, like Semur en Auxois, Saint-Vaubin, Colombey, Les Deux Églises, that's the Charles de Gaulle burial and hometown, Évreux-les-Bains, Villeneuve-sur-Loup. Like, I don't know, I'm really curious to see like what these places have, you know, these little roads going through kind of deep France. And when I think about what the Tour is, yeah, it's like all these mountain stages and big fans and lots of noise, but for, you know, for the introvert that I am as well, I really love those Tour stages where it's kind of quiet little towns, and, you know, like that sort of France in summertime, which isn't always like the big places. It's just the sort of the heat and the villages and the fields and the landscape and the kind of this sense that you're like disappearing off down this hole into a kind of like 50 years ago, almost this part of Europe that it doesn't really keep up to speed with the modern world. And we're going to have a great time kind of doing that. I think between the Alps and the Pyrenees, basically that whole sort of 10 days, no, the racing is going to have plenty to talk about, but as well, we're just going to wiggle our way around that sort of deep countryside, and like I'm looking forward to that a lot.
Me too. I feel like I'm there now, Mitch.
It's boulangerie country. It's some fantastic bakeries. I'm looking forward to discovering. Yeah. Isn't it? You know what I mean?
Like, that's all I envision. It's the boulangerie that's got like a faded sign. You know, and you look at it on the outside, and you're like, I don't know. But then you go in, and it's like, yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
No, I think that's what you want. The faded sign is a good sign. Before the second rest day, we've got two back-to-back beasts of stages in the Pyrenees, stages 14 and 15. Stage 14, Plat d'Aix, and then you've got the... finishes in Plat d'Aix, or on the Plat d'Aix, after climbing the Tourmalet. Just 152 kilometres for that one. Three climbs, two of them all category, as well as the summit finish. And then stage 15, Bastille Day. This one looks like one for the history books, doesn't it? 198 kilometres. It includes nearly 5,000 metres of climbing. Hits the Col de Perisord immediately. Then you've got three category one climbs, and it finishes on the Plateau de Baie. Talk to me about these two boys, because this is where we're going to see the really going to start to see the GC gaps.
I was looking at these stages on the maps, and just my first thought, which is almost a little bit tragic in a way, but I was like, God, that's going to be a long drive from start to finish, you know, all the way out the Pyrenees, along the motorway, and back in. But they are like, they're really big. They're covering some big distance, and it's like, right, you go over the, they go over the Pay Resort, and then they go over the Monte, and then they go over the Porte d'Aspe, and then they go over the, this one and this one. It's like, there's about 3 days riding for an amateur. You could, you know, have some nice little rides there. It's like kind of the classic, all of the classic Pyrenees, isn't it, in a lot of ways, wrapped up into two big days.
Yeah. Mitch, well, in terms of riders, who have you put down on your notes there? Because if I'm Tadej Pogacar, am I looking this far into the race as the point at which Jonas Vingegaard's form is really, or lack of form, is really going to tell?
Totally. Look, these 2 days, 14-15, you know, at the end of two, that period there in a Grand Tour is sort of, you know, you get into the third week and you sort of get to 17, 18, 19, it's all in. All chips are on the table. You're giving everything. This is that period where it's super hard, but you're like, there's still quite a long way to go. So you don't want to expose yourself, but you may be forced to. And exactly what you said, this could be the time where some things are going to get unraveled. Look, in my notes, I put 14 as pure sort of GC day. And, you know, I think even Yates maybe is going to be sort of showing there. Adam, if he shows that form that he showed that we just saw in Swiss. You know, Evenepoel, a guy that could be starting to show that really good form. But, of course, you know, Pogacar and I even put Bernal. Just sort of the way that there's quite a lot of climbing towards the end of the stage, it sort of suits him, how high they're going as well. You know, these are long shouts. You know, at the end of the day, I've probably got no idea. When fast forward to 15, I think it's going to be a bit more of a break day. Just the way that they're starting, straight up a Cat 1, that is brutal. Like, as a sprinter, you've just come off 14, which is a hell of a day, and you're starting the day before the second rest day with a Cat 1. You're just like, what the hell? Like, this is dangerous for guys going for time cut. Super, super dangerous day. But for guys who can climb well, like a Ciccone-style rider, this is a nice day for you. Get up the road, Bastille Day, as we always see, gives the Frenchies a lot of wings. It's you know, the first time I was reading, also the first time they finished up the Plateau de Belle, was in 98. Pantani won up there. So it's a relatively new climb to the tour. And they haven't featured up that climb many, many times. You know, it's a real GC battle anyway. If the break stays away, there'll still be a massive GC battle up that final climb.
Mm. Yeah, it's got a few, I mean, obviously by design, a few throwbacks to Italian yellow jersey winners from the past. Richard, before we exit out into the final part of this year's tour, a word on that Bastille Day bonanza.
Yeah, I would pity the kind of Mitch riders that you mentioned. You know, those boys who are going to be shot out the back on the Pay Resort. Now, I think it'd be really interesting just to see what the lay of the land is with the race at that point. I mean, I know that's kind of always the case with the mountain stages, but, you know, I don't think it's nailed on breakaway or GC day. I think if you have a situation where there's quite a tight fight for the GC at that point, when we get into the Pyrenees, it's going to be really tightly controlled, isn't it? And, you know, you can imagine that the breakaway opportunities might be quite limited, but, you know, if the situation, like what we saw in the Giro, was a little bit more set, then, you know, maybe that kind of offers a little bit more freedom and a team might be more content to let some riders get up the road. But yeah, I was going back through my old photos, and I think this was on Plateau de Bay, because we were there about 10 years ago, and it was an almighty traffic jam to get off. And it was just, I'm not sure it was Bastille Day, but it was your classic kind of slightly boozed up febrile atmosphere kind of all the fans coming down. And I found this photo of like just all of them like wandering down like the kind of after party of all the like the fancy dress and the cardboard signs and all this kind of like trudging down past the car as you went past. And it's, yeah, that is going to be busy, I think. That's going to be, it's down the main road from Toulouse, that climb, Plateau de Bay. Like, it's quite easy to get to. And the rest of the climbs on that route are a little bit more sort of in the back country of the Pyrenees. So I reckon Plateau de Bay is, I don't want to jinx it, but, you know, we've seen how in the past few years the kind of issues of fans getting pretty close to the riders and potentially affecting the racing. It was last year, wasn't it, on the Col de la Loz, maybe, if I remember rightly, where the motorbike that Thomas Voeckler was driving.
Traffic jam.
I have to check that. I don't want to slander unnecessarily Thomas Voeckler driving the motorbike, but I do remember somebody got thrown off the race for the day afterwards, but it wasn't really their fault because there were just so many fans. You know, you try driving a chunky motorbike up 14% when you've got about a foot of road to play with. Yeah, I mean, it's, well, who knows what we'll see. I mean, the sort of wider context that's worth bearing in mind is the French elections, which we've talked about before, but I'm quite curious to see what France we end up in, because the second round of those elections is on the gravel stage, on stage 9, and the political atmosphere and just the general kind of mood in the country is going to be quite tense around that stage. You know, this will ramp up as we get there, but depending on which way that election goes, you know, that it could be quite a sort of quite an interesting time to be traveling in France. And Bastille Day, the tour is not necessarily political, but it's also a huge billboard for people who have got something to say, whether that's Bastille Day or otherwise. And like, okay, so all these old pictures on my hard drive, most of the time that the things that people have got to say is like pretty lighthearted, and you know, it's not anything particularly sort of political or controversial. Although that is, if you read the story about the guys that go and scrub the rude words and the graffiti off the roads pre-tour, you read that, Mitch? Heard about those guys? I did a translation for Rouleur magazine a few years ago. This brilliant piece written by, and the name escapes me, a French journalist, about, they were called les effaceurs in French, which means like the eraser men, I think was the translation we came up with. And they're in a van, there's a few of them, and they go ahead of the race on the stage a few hours with like cans of paint, and they anything they see, so if it's like phalluses or political statements or rude words or syringes or like the word EPO or stuff, whatever they see on the road that is slightly insensitive to the television audience, they'll go and doctor it. And they often have this kind of race against time where like suddenly they'll hit a mountain climb and they know the race is chasing them, like breathing down the back of their neck, and then suddenly they've got like 50 words EPO, EPO, EPO written like up the climb. And yeah, so these guys go ahead every stage and kind of like sanitize it. Anyway, yeah, I digress. Plateau de Bay is they're going to need a lot of paint for Plateau de Bay, I would guess.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
Hello, Lionel again to tell you about our clothing partners MAP and their mid-year sale, which is still going, actually. And in fact, there's some additional discounts on some items. So you can get some really fantastic discounts on some very attractive kit at map.cc. That's MAAP.cc. I was out this morning on my bike. The English summer has finally arrived. By the looks of the forecast, it's lasting about 3 or 4 days this year, but it was gloriously hot and sunny this morning, and it gave me an opportunity to get out dressed head to toe in my MAP summer kit, and I felt fantastically fast out there on the road. I don't know if the data backs that up, but I certainly felt good. And if you want to look good and feel good on the bike, you can't go wrong with MAP clothing. So go to map.cc and have a look, especially at the moment as there are some really great discounts. You may have heard Mitch talking about his book, Life in the Peloton, which is available exclusively from map.cc. We did have some Comments from listeners in the United States saying they were having trouble ordering the book. I gather if you change the store location to the United States, you will be able to put the book Life in the Peloton into your shopping cart and order it as normal. So hopefully that helps you out if you've been struggling to order the book. Before I hand back to Graham, Mitch and Richard, a mention for Richard's fantastic Kilometre Zero series, a three-part series called Humongous Bunting. Looking back a decade, hard to believe it's been 10 years, but looking back to the 2014 Grand Depart in Yorkshire, a really nicely put together series. If you were there in Yorkshire, it's a very nice blast of nostalgia, but it's also looking at how the kind of boom, and I'm reluctant to say bust, of British cycling, because I don't think it's as dramatic as that, but certainly the Yorkshire Grand Depart was something of a high watermark, wasn't it? And Richard's series tells the story brilliantly. There's also a little cameo from Daniel and I in that series, so that will be available exclusively to friends of the podcast. It'll be dropping into your feed automatically on Wednesday. And if you'd like to sign up as a friend of the podcast and support us in the process, you can do so at thecyclingpodcast.com. Now I'm going to hand back to Graham, Mitch and Richard, and I hope you enjoy their company all the way from Florence to Nice.
So gents, one of the great things about the Tour de France, if you're in the start village at the beginning of each stage, you're surrounded by sponsors' tents, and there's the great and the good of cycling everywhere you look, and the sort of the buzz in the air for that day's race before it's all properly begun. And one of the incredibly decadent things that comes along with that is the array of food and drink from the region. Mitch, I know you're very excited to try a bit of what we see each morning, possibly if we're not on the road by then already. And it's almost like there's a tour sommelier doing the rounds, encouraging you to try wines from that part of France at sort of 9 o'clock in the morning. So it's quite a powerful way to start your day. But as exciting as all that is, it's also kind of the last thing you want at that time in the morning. Well, it's certainly the last thing I want at that time in the morning. Mitch, I don't know, you might feel slightly differently. It might be a great way to start the day. Anyway, we found our very own cycling podcast sommelier. He's Greg Andrews from Divine Cellars, and as part of his prep for the tour, Daniel Freeb had a chat with him.
Well, hello everyone. I am joined today by Greg Andrews of Divine Cellars in London. Regular listeners will know his voice. I'm sure they'll be familiar with the cases we do every year for the Giro d'Italia, Tour de France and Vuelta a España in conjunction with Divine Cellars of London. And Greg is here today to present the wines that he and his team have selected to celebrate the terroir of the 2024 Tour de France. Greg, what have you got for us this year?
Daniel, good afternoon, good evening, or good morning, whenever you're listening. Yeah, we've got a fabulous selection, I think, that showcases the terroir. This year, you know, as Daniel and I were discussing, we're starting in Italy, but because we do the Giro d'Italia, I didn't see much point. So we sort of jumped into the Savoie wine straight away, which I think hits about stage five. Where you know we've uncovered a sort of a fabulous producer, Francois Depros, which is now sort of his sixth generation. We've got a fabulous Jacquet, a crisp, fresh white wine, sort of from the Alps. It's sort of a good start, you know, a good start for this year's tour. Should keep us refreshed and sort of ready to go. Sort of as we then sort of cruise up to Burgundy quite quickly. Now. As listeners of the podcast know from previous years, Burgundy's always been a bit of a challenge to find something that bluntly fits our budget, but also something that's decent value for money. This year, we've definitely found that in the Domaine Corsan Mâcon, which, as we're starting stage five in Mâcon, you know, it'd be criminal not to showcase it. So, got a lovely sort of Chardonnay, nicely textured but not overblown. And, you know, it should certainly sort of appease, you know, our Francophile drinkers in the main. And then from there, sort of looping around to the west, the eastern fringes of the Loire Valley, we've got a brilliant Chevenix, where, you know, organic property that's been going since the 1890s. We've got a fabulous sort of Gamay Pinot blend. Again, it's the chillable number of the selection this year. So nice and fresh, some good berry fruit, but equally just a bit of tannic structure in the back end there that sort of means it's a little more serious than a straight Gamay or even a Cab Franc. It just sort of does a little bit more. Then down to the Pyrenees, we've got a fabulous Cahors.
That's the end of the tippy-tappy stuff, isn't it, Greg? After 3 wines in, we're into the serious stuff now. The kitchen sink can come out now, yeah.
Getting into the Pyrenees, getting into some nice bottle age with the Chateau Payas Cahors. Some deep mocha, sort of, big chocolate flavours coming through. I mean, yeah, Cahors is the home of Malbec, even though the Argentinians will argue that point. But their Malbec was basically sort of, I wouldn't say taken, but very much inspired from the original plantings in the Cahors. So, very much the spiritual home of Malbec, and very much the, where it really hails from in the main. So, a brilliantly sustainable producer, producing a fantastic, smooth, but nicely meaty Cahors that sort of sets us up as we follow down into the Languedoc, really, where we've got, we were spoilt for choice down here, but the winner of this area was the Lotus Blanc from Pic Saint-Loup, which is a Roussanne, Viognier, Sauvignon and Chardonnay blend with a bit of sort of Muscat Pénégrin, which, a really mineral type of wine grown on some limestone soils in the shadow of a huge rocky outcrop that kind of, I imagine, will mean some hills are on the agenda for this day. But what we've got is a really sort of good, solid wine, great to sit by the barbecue, that's a bit more serious, and should really have its fans in the tour. And then finally, we're finishing in Nice, which does mean rosé. We're in the heart of Provence. I know Daniel said it's the end of the tippy-tappy stuff, but as we're finishing in Provence, which I gather in Nice, it's not going to happen every year. So look, it'd just be totally rude and out of order to do anything but Provence Rosé. So we've got a cracking estate here who single-handedly revitalised my faith, or some faith, in Provence last year when I went to visit these guys, a really solid organic project that, for me, over-delivers it in comparison with some of the other rosés you get down in Provence. So, a fully organic certified project in the nature reserve, it really does sort of show a bit of spice, a bit of character that, if I may say so, a lot of Provence rosés are void of, really. So definitely got a decent drink at this one.
And Greg, that one is called Les Deux Anges, the Two Angels, and the Tour de France is going to be finishing in the Bay of Angels in Nice. So very apt. I will let you off. Really, we should be starting with a pink wine because we're starting in Italy, the home of the Giro d'Italia. However, I will grant you a royal pardon. Greg, how do our listeners acquire the selection this year?
So this year, we'll be launching the case online this week from the 25th of June. Be available online and in store. If you are collecting in store, do give us a heads up so we can make sure we've got it ready for you. Otherwise, you can buying it online is the easiest way. You can either click to collect from in-store or have it delivered nationally within the UK.
And that is Divine Cellars. That's all one word. The letter D. Yeah, the letter D, then Vine, then Cellars.com. Greg, bon Tour de France, and thank you very much.
Well, chaps, the obvious question to ask off the back of Daniel's chat with Greg there is, who will we be raising a glass to come the finish in Nice in terms of the overall, in terms of the GC? I mean, one man stands above all, Richard. Should we start with him?
I thought you were saying I stood above all then. Are we talking about Tadej Pogacar?
Enric Mas.
That's also true. But I think we have to talk about Tadej Pogacar briefly.
Oh, right.
I was going for Tadej Pogacar. Opinions might differ. Who, if anyone, from the rest of the peloton would get in the UAE team?
Would get into the team? That's a good question, actually.
I mean, Mathieu van der Poel, possibly. But then would they, for what they're going for, would they really need him on sheer ability, van der Poel?
It's all for one, isn't it? They might put Simon Yates in there, just, you know, kind of for the crack, but also
Vlasov?
Because
Vlasov would get in there, wouldn't he?
I
think Vlasov. Because let's imagine for a second that Roglic would not ride for Pogacar. Vlasov obviously was man of the match during the Dauphiné for Roglic, and just turned himself inside out every single day on those climbs.
I think I'd put a little bit more experience in there. I was looking at the number of tours some of these guys have done. Juan Ayuso and João Almeida are both making their tour debut for UAE. They've not ridden the tour before for anybody. Pavel Sivakov has ridden one tour before for Ineos Grenadiers. So, you know, it does look really strong on paper, but it doesn't necessarily have that experience. And I think that does count to some extent. If you're a rider like Pogacar at the Giro, like he was there, it doesn't count because he's so far ahead of everybody else that that experience doesn't matter. But if things get really tough and really gnarly, I think having that kind of sang-froid and like calm head of dealing with the stress that can come with the tour, like uniquely in the tour, I think that will, you'd rather have it than not.
Because that final week, we've got a stage for the sprinters to Nîmes. If several of them make it that far, and then we've got the return to the Alps and the little known ski resort of Super Dévoulie, and then stages 19 and 20 are high mountain stages again with two summit finishes before that final day time trial, which obviously features the Col d'Ers, which also might throw a spanner in the works for some. We've seen, obviously, in recent memory, both at the Tour and the Giro, when time trials on the last day go uphill, interesting things can happen. We've not really mentioned Primoz Roglic, gents. How is he going to fare among all of this?
Look, coming out of Swiss, you know, Dauphiné, he was looking the dolphin. He was looking like amazing, and the only kink in the armor was that final stage, you know, and that was the only question now that is put there. But I like the squad around him with Hindley, of course,
And Bora totally, have got experience from last year.
I think that's the big point. You really made a really good point there, Richard. That the experience does play a card in such a race. It is a high stress race. Everyone speaks about it. The big difference between the Tour and the other two Grand Tours is the extra stress, the pressure, you know, the stuff outside the race. And he's an experienced GC man now. So he's been there before. He's been there many times before, you know, multiple Grand Tour winner. So I like Roglic. I like him more than Vingegaard, in my opinion, just where he's come from and, you know, the unknown with Vingegaard. So it's easy to say that. But, yeah, I'm really liking Primoz.
And like the kind of the redemption arc in his story as well, the chance to make amends with a final stage time trial. I know it wasn't the last stage when he lost on Planche de Belfi, but, you know, he's kind of got history, hasn't he? I mean, it went the other way around in the Giro that he won last year. But, yeah, if I were a kind of a script editor for a film or even like writing a feature, you know, I would kind of want to structure my piece like this race, you know, like big exciting start, kind of intrigue and interest in the middle, and then like a huge spectacular fireworky finish to go out with a bang. And that's kind of what we've got with like these high altitude climbs, bit of an unknown climb, the Col de la Cuillole on the penultimate stage, and then this time trial at the Col d'Ers, which is just going to be lurking in the riders' minds, you know, like nothing is set until that TT. You know, riders could lose big chunks of time or gain big chunks of time on that. And it's going to be such a different proposition to what the Tour has always been, which has been, well, certainly in my memory, but in recent memory, which has been the sort of ceremonial stage on the Champs-Élysées.
Mitch, talking of experience, a man you spoke to in the past week, Geraint Thomas, for your other podcast, I was thinking about him as possibly being a surprise top six contender, because you just know what you're going to get from him. And if Bernal and Carlos Rodriguez, who are Ineos's main men for the tour, if they fall away, you know Geraint Thomas is going to be able to stick with it, and he's going to be able to chug through these high mountain stages. Okay, he's not going to have the same explosiveness as Pogacar, as Roglic. He's not necessarily going to be up there when the GC men sort of make a break for the line, but he's going to be there or thereabouts.
Totally, and that's a question that I asked him. How does he go from being a leader to suddenly slipping back into being a, you know, a helper? You know, what about the ego that's involved with that? You know, he's got to drop back and just maybe thinking with legs feeling great, actually, I could be up there. That could be an element between them, having three sort of leaders there, even though, you know, Geraint, he never mentioned that he's interested in doing that. If anything, he said he's looking forward to just dropping back a role and enjoying and embracing the tour as a non-leader and actually absorbing the atmosphere from the race. But in saying all that, he's obviously back up, well, not obviously, but he is back up at Isla 2000. He's training with the team. The double, it's something we've been talking about a lot. The thing that I would only say in the older riders' sort of undoing is that there's a lot more for you to miss about that time being away from home. Geraint, he's got his own, you know, his own son, his wife, of course, and to go from doing the altitude camp before the Giro, home for a week, straight up to altitude again, on another tour. I don't know. I just don't know how these guys do it now, like psychologically. This is intense. He's 38 years old. Yeah, it's a big one. So, look, I think Rodriguez, I really like how he's looking, and I don't see him coming undone. He's just looking really solid. Mm. Bernal is a question mark around him. And I think Thomas is just going to be solid. I don't think, you know, excellent going for the win, but just always there.
Richard, I think something worth mentioning as well in the context of the whole race and Pogacar in particular, maybe, is we know that Pogacar really likes the wet. And this race doesn't go north. It doesn't go west. It doesn't really go that near the sea. And it's pretty southern. I was looking at the forecast. It's going to be early 30s, 33 or something when we land in Florence. It's going to stay that way for a while. So I think the heat is going to be a factor, especially in that final week when we get into those climbs. You know, like the Bonnet, for example, is exposed. It's hot, like it's southern. It's high up. These are all going to be kind of pretty challenging conditions. And I think keeping cool and that kind of heat management strategy is going to be pretty forefront of most of the riders' minds and the team's minds. Pogacar, it's not like he's weaker in the heat, but those bad days that he has had in the tour have been when it's been hot. Last year on the Col de la Loz, wasn't it? I think, if memory serves me correctly.
Yeah.
Just after the TT. So, and that would be the issue for Pogacar, wouldn't it? If he's going to do the double, he's got to sustain that kind of form right through to the last day, that Col d'Huez TT.
And on form, where do we think Remco Evenepoel is now for Soudal Quick-Step? Because they have gone all in with their selection to support him. We know the time trials are going to suit him. But what we possibly learned from the Dauphiné is that although he will be exceptionally good in the time trials, it's when the race ramps up and the road goes high, that even though he has got that support of Mikel Landa, of Ilan Van Wilder, of Jan Herr, Yves Lampaert, Gianni Moscon, it's not necessarily going to suit him quite as well as it suits Roglic, as it suits Pogacar and Vingegaard.
In what respect?
In that he didn't look as strong at the Dauphiné as he did the rest of the contenders, and when the going got tough, he fell away. But he's had two or three more weeks since
I think
then.
The argument for him is he's building. He's in a building phase. He's probably going to be in a very similar state to Jonas. He's building, and he's just got that raw talent there that he's going to be good. We can't discount him.
Richard, one other rider I wanted to mention was Bahrain Victorious's Santiago Buitrago, because he's going to be their main man, we think, or we know. What chance does he have of podiuming?
He's not on my top five. I'm not sure I'd put him in my top 10, actually. really not. I don't think he's just got the pedigree or the track record of, you know, competing with those guys, those sort of top four that we've talked about all year. Mm. I think what we're more likely to see, in fact, is, you know, a super domestique getting up there in the top 10, such as the gulf now between those two teams in particular, Visma Lisebike and UAE. But, you know, what we saw at Suisse with UAE and the way they were riding, you know, you can almost imagine a scenario where someone like Adam Yates, Sepp Kuss, had he been there, actually kind of sneaks into the top five almost by mistake, you know, by virtue of trying to help their team leader. That would be my kind of left field. You know, I sort of had a go at writing what I thought my top five would be. And it was Pogacar, Vingegaard, Roglic, Rodriguez, and then one of the Yateses. I couldn't quite cut between Simon or Adam. I know it's pure speculation at this point, but I didn't put Evenepoel up there. I was looking for more from him from the Dauphiné, like a statement of kind of credentials, I suppose, you know, going into the tour, that he was, because you can still build, but be higher than he was, I think. Although that said, the time trial was pretty impressive. I don't know. He's still a big question mark for me, and I know there will be so much pressure on him from the Belgian press at that race. It'll be really intense 3 weeks for him, because he's the main, apart from Jesper Philipsen, he's such a big story for that kind of cycling mad nation. Yeah. And you know, the Belgian media is going to be all over him for the whole time. So that will be hard to manage.
I wouldn't be surprised if we saw a 1-2 from UAE with Tadej Pogacar and Adam Yates, given Yates's time trialing form at the Tour de Suisse. And then I'd probably add Roglic to the podium there. Mitch, what are you saying for your final three?
Pogacar, I'm throwing Rodriguez in there. And Roglic, I said, yeah, look, I'm going to go on a whim. If we're going to talk about a GC guy, I like Jorgensen. A helper. I really like Jorgensen.
Yeah.
I like his determination. I like his hunger. And I think it's going to be his tour to shine. So he's in there for me. He's a top five.
And Visma Lisebike have said that they, although he is not one of their leaders, they will also ride tactically, play the numbers, and that they will not have him deliberately lose time either. My surprise contender for the top five would be Geraint Thomas. He's going to find a way to get in there, I'm telling you.
I was wondering about the other G, Derek G.
Oh, of course.
Probably not a surprise contender anymore, yeah. But...
Yeah, well, he was going to be my other.
Let's keep an eye on him.
He was going to be my other pick for a possible early yellow jersey for Israel Premier Tech to really stamp their mark on the race. Right, Mitch has got to go and pack his bags and get out of Dodge. Mitch, we will look forward to seeing you in Nice for that road trip down to Florence. And the next time we will see each other, we will be recording. We'll be close to recording the first episode on the road for the cycling podcast at the Tour de France. So with that, I will say good luck, travel safe, and look forward to seeing you. Any last minute prep things you've got to get done before you go?
Spend some time with my wife, and that's about it, really. It's wife and kids tomorrow. So I'm trying to spend as much time as I can with them before a month away. So I'm pretty much ready to go, and the rest will fall into place.
Quite right. And not a man who leaves anything to the last minute. So well organised is he. But Richard, any last bits you need to take care of?
All my veggies are just coming into fruit. The first tomatoes and cukes are making their way out. And just in time for me to leave. So they're basically my children at the moment.
I hope you've got someone taking care of those.
Tenderly harvesting them and making sure the pickling instructions are very clear.
Super stuff. Right, gents, thank you for your company. I look forward to seeing you both in Nice.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Free, and Lionel Byrne.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch, Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.